Okay, we are now in session as the Judiciary Finance Division, and I will note that a quorum is present. We're going to proceed in a moment with the budget overview from our Senate Fiscal Analyst, Chris Turner. I will note that you've got your budget notebooks in front of you. It contains all the information that we've been given that Chris is going to go over. We have present with us representatives from, I think, all the budget categories except the Public Defense Board and the Human Rights Commissioner, but they are available in the building and can be here within about 5 minutes if there are any questions on those topics, so let us know. And also, there was a question came up relating to the Private Detectives Board during their budget presentation earlier. In your packets is a memorandum from the director of the Private Detectives Board responding to the number of inquiries or applications they receive, the number of applications that proceed and are approved, and so on. So take a look at that memo for more information. So, Mr. Turner, why don't you go ahead and take us through the budget.
Mr. Chairman, members, as the chairman said, my name is Chris Turner. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee.
Chris, why don't you pull the mic closer to you as well?
And what I'm going to be doing is going over the governor's budget. This is nothing new. It's been public for 2.5 weeks, but what I've done is aggregate it into a 5-page spreadsheet. So I've turned the book into your spreadsheet. I'm going to teach you how to read the spreadsheet, then quickly go over the budget, and then summarize some of the more important points. First of all, if you look at the spreadsheet, the first thing I'd like to explain to you on using these is the date and timestamp on the lower right-hand corner. That's very important later in the session when these numbers are changing and I'm printing off different spreadsheets. So this, we'll all know that we're on the current updated spreadsheet. I'm pointing that out to you right now. Everybody should be February 12, 2013 at 8:11 a.m. I'll just explain the column headings real quick. We've got, of course, the agency and the program. We have the fund is the next column. This budget is 99.5% general fund. There's only a few special fund items, and I'll talk about them when I get there. Then we have fiscal year 12 and 13 biennium for comparative purposes. Then we have the biennium we're concerned with here, 14 and 15, by year and by total. And then we have the 16 and 17 tails, and this is all based on the governor's budget. The numbers are in thousands. For example, if you see 3,000, it's actually 3 million. If you see 98, it's 98,000, et cetera. For the first one, I'll run it through as an example. If you look at Supreme Court operations, which is our Supreme Court with its 7 judges and the state court administrator, and on line 3, that is the base funding line. Base funding is almost always determined by the funding level the second year of the previous biennium. So if you look, base funding for Supreme Court operations, 30.7 million in 14, 30.7 in 15, for a total of 61,518. Then in lines 5 through 8 are the decision items or governor's initiatives, and they're broken out. Health insurance increase, 9 and 9.9. Employee salary increase of 3% a year. Judge salary increase of 4% a year, and then the state share of the judge's pension increase. And then you add all of them up, and you come up with a total appropriation on line 10 of $64,171,000. And that is the number. Actually, we'd be budgeting it by year. The $31,632,000 and $32,539,000 would be the numbers that will actually show up in the bill once we pass it next month. And real quick, the tails for like I mentioned earlier, the tails are determined by the appropriation in the second year of the previous biennium. So if you look at, for example, line 5, health insurance increase, For the first year, it's a $265,000 appropriation. The second year, it's a $567,000. So then if you go over to 16 and 17, we carry the $567,000 for both years. Okay? That's how base budgeting works. There's some exceptions in formulaic change items, but we've only got one of those in this budget, and it's with the corrections prison population. Like I said, these are the governor's increases. What we're going to do, what the committee and the Senate are going to do, is put together a bill a month from now that the public will be much more interested in, because this is public knowledge. When that comes out, it won't be. Then this spreadsheet will grow. We will have a Senate column. We'll have a House column. Then we'll hide the governor's column because we're running out of work. Then we'll have a conference committee column. And 2 years ago, we even had a second conference committee column because the first bill was vetoed. But by the end of the session, I will have a history of the bill that starts with base funding, the governor's rec, the Senate bill, the House bill, the conference agreement, and then the signed governor's law. And that's very useful to have. Well, certainly it is for me, answering your questions down the road. Hey, I'm going to just quickly go through the spreadsheet right now, if you'll indulge me that. I've already gone through Supreme Court operations. The Supreme Court is also the fiscal agent for civil legal services. So on line 12, we've got civil legal, and I'm going to be speaking in biennial numbers here. The civil legal base is $22,032,000. On line 14, the governor has requested an additional $1 million. For a total governor's request of $23,032,000. Line 18 is the total of the Supreme Court, meaning Supreme Court operations plus civil legal services. Move down to Court of Appeals. We have a base of $20,456,000. We have the same four decision items, only broken out proportionately for the appeals court, which has 19 judges and correspondingly more staff. So we've got health insurance increases, a 3% employee salary, 4% judicial salary, and then the state judge, the judge's pension increase. And for a total request for the Court of Appeals of $21,664,000. Move on to the district courts. Of course, there's 289 district court judges. This is the meat of the budget. Correspondingly more staff members. Their base is $473,656,000. We have the four identical decision items figured proportionally for a total judicial request of $502,825,000 for the district courts. Move on to the guardian ad litem board. We have a base of $24,134,000. Two decision items, the full salary increase and a portion of the health insurance increase that the board requested for a total appropriation of $25,170,000. For the tax court, it has a base of $1,650,000. They're requesting money for two law clerks, Westlaw access, and continuing legal education. That's $322,000 a year. Total request of $1,972,000. Uniform Laws Commission, the base is $98,000 a year, and the governor recommends base funding. Board of Judicial Standards, the base is $912,000 a year. There's a one-time request for a disciplinary and two disability hearings of $300,000 for a total appropriation request of $1,212,000. Move on to page 3, the Public Defense Board, line 66. They have a base of $131,952. They have a one-line item, which includes caseload reduction and salary increases of $8,595,000 for a governor's request of $145,470. The Post Board, this is one of our only special revenue accounts. It's funded by a portion of the $75 criminal and traffic surcharge. It's got a base of $7,540,000. The governor recommends base funding. Same with the Private Detective Board, base funding at $240,000. Human Rights Department, base funding of $6,336,000. The governor recommends two enforcement officers for a total request of $6,594,000. Then we get to our big account, the Department of Corrections. They have three divisions: Institutions, Community Services, and Operations Support. Institutions is on page three. We have a small special revenue appropriation. That's for money that they make from housing federal inmates at Rush City. That's $1,160,000.
Mr. Turner, what discretion do we have with regard to the special revenue accounts?
Mr. Chairman, as far as, oh, you mean spending them?
As a committee, in terms of spending decisions.
Mr. Chairman, on this line, we really don't have that much. It's there for them to authorize them to spend it. They're not even sure they're going to bring in that much money at Rush City this year. This is a line just giving them the authority to spend the money that they may bring in under contract. However, on Peace Officers Board, you've got all the discretion you want. That's a special revenue account, and you can cut it or you can add to it. And that will, if you cut it, it will add to your general fund money available, and if you add to it, it will subtract from your total general fund money available.
So because in that particular account, we could swipe from that special revenue account, sweep it into the general account within our budget category, and use it for other purposes if we wanted to, theoretically.
Mr. Chairman, no, not on this one.
I mean for the post board.
No, because anything the post board is funded by the $75 surcharge, and actually, I mean, it's really bizarre. It's funded by the first 39% of the first $25 of the $75 of the surcharge, okay? I think I got that right.
Easy.
Everything else goes to the general fund. So if we spend more, we take away from the general fund. If we spend less, the general fund gets more in this account. It's kind of a sponge.
Just because of the way that particular is set up.
Right. All right. Now, the fire safety account, which you've heard of, I'm sure, that was an account that we could raid, you know, and as the legislature did. But that was set up differently.
Let me hasten to add for the record, I'm not considering doing what I just talked about theoretically. Just want to make sure I understand how this works.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Mr. Turner.
The base for the institutions of the Department of Corrections is $662,250,000. DOC is asking for $38 million total. $32,460 would go to the prison system, which, of course, is the lion's share of the department, for a total institutions appropriation general fund of $694.7 million. So to the next page, we have community services, which is there are probation systems, whether it's the CCA, CPO, or the DOC-run systems, and it includes all the pass-through grants to the counties. It's got a base of $222,588,000. That includes $37 million a year for the CCA counties and $4.8 million a year for the CPO counties. They're requesting salary and health insurance increases of $3,844,000. That's for state employees only. That does not include new money for CCA or CPO, for a total appropriation of $226,432. Operations support is the central office, administration, finance, research, et cetera. They have a $43.1 million base. Their proportion of salary and health care increases is $1,696,000 for a total of $44,755,000. So as you can see, corrections total general fund, $965,897. We have one small agency left, sentencing guidelines, whose base is $1,172,000. They're requesting a one-time appropriation in the first year for an electronic sentencing worksheet for a total appropriation of $1,472,000. If you go to the back, we have our totals, and we have revenue adjustments for the general fund. This is here for me to track anything that you do if you decide to raise revenue, or in the post board's case, switch out revenue. Right now, it's zero. Then we have our targets, The target here is the governor's target. We will no doubt receive a different target. And that's just tracking whether we balance on the last line. So essentially, okay, we've got a judiciary-based budget of $1,672,053,000. Then we've got the governor's recommended increases. I think I put this little summary page out of $82,841,000 for a total appropriation of $1,754,894,000, which is the last number on the last line. I'd just like to talk real quickly about our three big accounts. Obviously, the Department of Corrections is the biggest account in this budget. It's a $966 million request. It's $38 million over base. I'd like to explain how we got here. We've had 30 years of growth in the inmate population, very steady growth. And that's resulted in a build-out in the system. For decades, male corrections was Stillwater and St. Cloud. But then meaning the state, we converted Lionel Lakes from a juvenile facility to an adult facility, I think in the late 60s, early 70s. We built Oak Park Heights in the late 70s. We converted two state hospitals, Moose Lake and Faribault, into prisons in the late 80s and early 90s. The state built a boot camp at Willow River in 94. And finally, it built Rush City in 1998. So not that long ago, it was Stillwater and St. Cloud, and now we've got eight adult male, one adult female at Shakopee, and two juvenile facilities in the system. They've got 9,500 inmates and approximately 4,300 employees. With this growth has come criticism of costs. And for years, the legislature has leaned on the DOC to cut its marginal and capital costs, and the department has done its best to comply. Almost all of the system that can be double bunked now is double bunked. In construction, staff efficient prison designs have replaced inefficient hospital wings. Basically, it's a pretty cost-effective system. As for his budget, in the last 4 years, the DOC has absorbed a biennial base cut of $4 million in 2009, $8.8 million in 2010, and $5.6 million in 2011, for a total biennial base cut of over $18 million in the last 4 years.
Mr. Turner, what percentage would that be then?
That would be... what would I base that on? It'd be a couple percent. The whole point is the budget is personnel driven. It's driven by salary and benefits. This request and health care. This request doesn't have any expanded programming and no pass-through grants to CCA or CPO. And as the department pointed out, it assumes the department will operate on a 4% employee vacancy rate when it's historically preferred to operate on a 2% vacancy rate. Second biggest request is from the courts, a $588 million request for all three courts, with a $33 million change item. Once again, 2,500 employees, 315 judges in 10 districts. It's a personnel-driven budget. There hasn't been a permanent salary increase for staff or judges since 2008. Since the judges are asking for a salary increase, I thought I'd just give them to you. Currently, a district judge makes $129,000. Under this proposal, in 2014, it would go up $5,000 to $134,000, and in 2015 it would go up to $139,000. And then finally, the other big account is the public defender. $140.5 million request, of which $8.6 million is above base. two things to keep in mind. Number one, they lost their $75 attorney license fee this biennium, and that resulted in a loss to their budget of $3.8 million, essentially a base cut. And the other thing is that the public defender is a critical component of the system. The system only moves as fast as it's slow its member, and you have to adequately fund every player for the system to function smoothly. And the PD is definitely a very critical part of the court system. And that, Mr. Chairman and members, is the judiciary budget. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Turner? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if these questions should go to Mr. Turner or to the agencies, but the question I have on line 51, going to the tax court, perhaps if there's someone representing the tax court in the room, they might be able to answer this. There's a discussion of the breakdown on the tax court decision items, the two law clerks versus Westlaw and the continued legal education. Do we have a breakdown of those expenses? They're kind of jumbled together in one pot.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, we don't have a breakdown yet, but that is definitely on its way.
Mr. Chair, I would be
Senator
interested
Limmer.
In knowing the salaries of the law clerks as well as how much we're going to pay for continued legal education, and I suppose once we know those two things, we'll know the other balance on Westlaw involvement.
Mr. Chairman, I'll get that for you.
Senator Limmer, I don't know if you had stepped out of the room when the tax court made their presentation, but there's a, by statute since the 1970s, I think when they were formed, they've had judges. Even though their caseload has more than quadrupled, the judicial units have not increased at all. So the idea of adding the law clerks and the accessibility to electronic legal research, try to make them capable of processing the much increased caseload without a huge budget impact, which would be involved in adding judicial units. And because by statute they're required to have an odd number of judges, so that when they hear in panel there aren't any tie decisions, if you were to do that, add judges, we'd have to add two. This might actually be the most cost-efficient approach to the tax court, which has notably been behind in keeping up with their caseload. But the information that with the breakdown will be most helpful.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
I would have a similar question regarding the Public Defense Board on line 68-69, salary increases versus caseload reduction. Is there anyone from the Public Defense Board that could answer the question of how that's specifically divided between the salary increase and the caseload reduction effort?
Senator Lemmer, I can confirm that it's there in another meeting. Senator, I can call that.
It's up to the
Please.
Chair.
We'll bring them over from their meeting at the Judicial Center to answer the questions in the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, I know you will be going through a process to prepare a budget for the judiciary, and I just want to be upfront and say at this point I do not support raising judicial salaries, and I hope that you will consider my opposition to that. It's not that I oppose judges having an increase in salaries. It would be better for everyone if we could afford to raise their salaries. But I'm concerned that, number one, I think we would be better off having more judges. I believe that the judges are working as hard as they can, but I believe that we should reduce their caseload, not by giving them more money, but by adding additional judges. And I think that would be a better use of whatever funds we might be able to allocate to the judiciary. I am also concerned they have a very loud and strong advocacy and bully pulpit here at the legislature. I know we have great respect for our judges, but I also think that there are other employees in the judicial system that warrant the same consideration. I would note that legislators, not that I'm complaining, have not had salary increases either. I would say that's more as a function of the economy than it is anything else, and I think that that should apply to our judges as well. These are not the economic times to give out raises. Our families are struggling. Our businesses are struggling. People aren't getting raises. And I think that a judicial position is well compensated in the state of Minnesota. If it weren't, I'd probably have a very different view of this, but I think that it is adequately compensated. And I just wanted to share that for those of you that will be developing that first budget bill for this committee.
For what it's worth, Senator Ortman, a judge, district court judge in Minnesota, now makes less than a first-year associate makes at the large corporate firms in Minnesota, at Dorsey, at Fagry, at all of those firms. And these are the judges that are making the decisions on multi-million, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars worth of in dispute. So, and while it is true the legislatures haven't had a pay increase in at least, 12 or 14 years, and that's been a function not only of economic circumstances, but even in the good times, there wasn't the political will to do that. So even if we kept up with inflation, I think we'd be at about $45,000 or $48,000 annual salary, and we'll be in a position to make our contribution to health fund if we were kept up. So there's a lot of state employees have gone a long time without salary increases. But we are giving salary increases or anticipating doing so. We just did with approvals of certain contracts as well. So I'm not sure we ought to categorically exclude any groups of state employees from that process. Well, Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I respect your view. However, being a judge is public service. And certainly there are other options. People make choices when they want to serve in elected or public office, and I don't think there's if you look at the totality of salaries in the legal profession, that that $129,000 is too low. I think if they want to make money, they should go and make money. If they want to do public service and serve as a judge, I think that they have to recognize that they can't be as well compensated as they can in a private law firm.
I think, Senator Ortman, they know that. But what you end up with is a disproportionate. It's harder to get lawyers with a lot of private law firm experience to apply for judicial positions than it is to get lawyers who are looking at a step up in salary because they've already been in public service. And I just want to make sure we've got a salary structure that's got enough incentive to bring the balance onto the bench of those who have experience in the full range of disputes that they'll be considering. But I'm sure this conversation will, this is not the end of the conversation, I'm sure.
Mr. Senator Chair, Ortman. I don't disagree with your view, but there's such a shortage of money that I would hope that we would be funding new judicial positions. If the backlog is the justification, then let's have more judges, because adding more money to their salary is not going to reduce that backlog.
I'm not sure backlog is the justification for a salary increase. The fact that they fall into lowest third in the nation in their salary levels compared to other states, and the fact that they haven't had a salary increase since 2008 is the justification that they're proposing. The backlog is being proposed to be addressed through other parts of the system, like funding the public defense complement. Any other thoughts on this topic or any other questions? Senator Limmer.
Not on the judicial comment or the subject, but on another line item on the
jump right
presentation. If I could direct our attention to page 4 on the community service portion of the Department of Corrections budget. I see on line 104, community services. Mr. Turner, can you tell me, does this include probation officers?
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer.
What does it include? Maybe that's a better question.
This is, in my best understanding, although we can get the commissioner up here if we'd like, That is state probation officers, that line, 2004. I don't believe that that includes any county CCA or county probation officer reimbursement officers.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Turner, am I to understand that this is to give a potential salary and health insurance increase? I don't think that's itemized either on this page. So I probably would want to know that as well. But this would only cover the state employee probation officer and not the community corrections counterpart to that. And aren't they kind of equal in law as far as what they do? One is just hired by one versus the other, but they're both at the aren't they both at the direction of the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lumber, I'm going to defer to the department on this, but I really believe that a lot of that number is people who do other things within community services. I don't know how much of that number is DOC state probation, and because there are other people that work in community services besides the people who just provide probation in the state counties. But I'm at a loss. I'll defer to the department.
Anyone here from the Department of Corrections want to take a stab at that? Commissioner?
Should break it out.
Commissioner Roy, welcome to the committee. You can go ahead and close the computer top there if you wish. It's an old presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Sitting to my left is Christopher Dodger, Chief Financial Officer, who has those percentages ingrained in his mind.
Thank you, Mr.
Just to get to the political description, if I may, much of probation services, parole services, are provided by the county, either the Community Corrections Act counties or the county probation offices. That's about 75% community services. Supervision is provided by the county. And Mr. Dodge has those numbers exactly.
Mr. Dodge, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Approximately 19% of the community services budget is for DOC-provided probation and supervised release. So that would be, those would be state employees providing that service. About 59% of the community services budget is pass-through money to CCA and CPO counties. Those are not state employees.
But it's intended to offset the county's costs then of paying their employees?
So the increase, the governor's recommendation for the increase is for the state employees who provide probation and supervised release.
And so the pass-through then is intended to help the counties pay for the employees that are would otherwise have to be provided by state employees if they didn't do it.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dodge, the salary increases that are represented in this page 104 on page 4, am I to understand that this salary increase is only for state employees, not for community correction community correction probation officers? It's whatever money goes there, the 59% that you talked about, that's basically for their regular budget. It's not for any salary increase. Is that correct?
Mr. Dodge.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lemire, you're correct. The amount, the increase is for the state employees. The distribution to the of pass-through money goes to those counties for them to spend as they need to.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
the department is not asking on behalf of the community probation officers for any increase in salary. They're only asking for state employees.
Mr. Dodge.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, that's what this request is, for just state employees.
Mr. Chair, do we ever, or perhaps you can answer a question, do we pay state employees more, or state probation officers more, than our community correction counterparts? And is there ever a dispute or a tension or a frustration between the two that kind of do the same job?
Mr. Dodge?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Roy would like to answer that political question. Mr. Dodge was correct in his description that we pass through money to the counties, and the counties have their own salary systems that we do not control. And we, in my previous capacity, we did do a survey of probation officers, and the state of Minnesota probation officers fall pretty much in the mid-range salaries for, and the there are counties that pay less and there are counties that pay more. But there is no uniform salary system for those officers, and how they progress through steps, their retirement options vary between the counties.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
I might suggest this line of questioning isn't a political question, it's a policy question. I'm just trying to determine if we get an equal service, why aren't we closer in equal pay and compensation? I understand that the county I come from is historically higher on judicial staff costs and other things. Despite the fact that they might be state employees, they seem to get a little bit more money that way. But that's not your department, Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Dodge, I understand that that $3.8 million increase is essentially to just to, is that to fund the collective bargaining agreements, the increases that are in those collective bargaining agreements?
Mr. Chair, the increase will fund 2%, the 2% collective bargaining agreements that will be retroactive back to January 1st if they're ratified by both the Senate and the House. It also goes to fund health insurance increases of 9% per year and step increases.
Okay. So the health insurance increases are a figure that is given to you by Minnesota Management and Budget, right? So you don't have any discretion in that figure, correct?
Mr. Chair, we didn't receive specific instructions this year on how to project for health insurance, but it is consistent with what we have done in the past and how we've been instructed by MMB to make those projections in the past.
Okay, so the 9% is what you anticipate as the MMB guidance, if you will.
In essence, correct.
And then it covers the contracts that would be retroactive to January 1st of this year. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, correct. It would cover the 2% increase that has already been negotiated and maybe ratified. It does not include projections for any additional increases that may be bargained for the current for the 14-15 biennium.
Okay. So, but it does cover step increases for the 14-15 biennium,
Mr.
Right?
Chair, yes, it does.
Right. So if this amount were approved, the governor's recommendation were approved, you'd be able to maintain the current level of staffing. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, the $38 million will maintain our current level of staffing. Correct.
What happens
with
if
the 4% vacancy rate, which is very difficult right now, but we've been running a 4%, and we feel as though we will step up and manage that.
But your normal vacancy rate is 2%, right?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would consider a normal vacancy rate is anywhere between 2 and 2.5% for our department.
So, as I understand it, you're not leaving vacant positions or shifts uncovered in the direct supervision of the inmates, right? So I assume it's management that is being juggled here with the higher vacancy rate?
Mr. Chair, there are always some security positions that just because of turnover are vacant, but yes, we certainly put our priority on filling those positions first, the security positions first.
So what happens, you've got, what happens if you don't get the $3.8 million
increase the governor's recommending in terms of the number of FTEs you're able to maintain?
Mr. Chair, if we don't get the $38 million, it could mean the $38 million is equivalent to approximately 273 FTEs by fiscal year 15. So, it could mean the elimination and layoff of anywhere between zero and 273 employees.
And if the bargained for contracts for the next biennium include a salary increase, you'd have to somehow account for that in there too, right? Or we'd have to account for it somehow, one or the other.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. I don't want to, I would assume we probably would ask for a supplement next year.
Because it's unlikely we'll have maybe we'll have contracts to ratify before the end of the session, but it might be uncertain by the time we make this budget.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Mr. Right. Chair, question.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Turner, are you familiar with a statute I was just told about, 244.19 subdivision 6? That's a statute that requires 50% of probation services to counties under a population of 200,000 people would get 50% of their probation services paid for by the state. Have we ever met that since we passed that statute?
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, 1996 was the last time we were at 50%.
Senator Limmer.
Well, I guess I have a question then. We're asking for salary increases for state employees. We're stepping, well, maybe by law we don't have a responsibility to the community correction people. But somewhere along the way, we're not living up to the law that we had regarding the 50% payment to those counties that are in low population. And I don't know what comes first, salary increases to some or the obligation in law since prior to 1996 of these counties that are low in population but need the help. And for some reason, regardless of majorities, we haven't seemed to have fulfilled that law. And I don't know if we're going to have that conversation between now and the end of session or not, but I would imagine if I was a county administrator, a community correction administrator, I'd probably be rapping at the door of the legislature saying, hey, what about this little law here that we haven't gotten our pay for in 1996? I know that we're all kind of inheritors of previous budgets, but I guess I have to raise that question if there's any legislative will to keep this on the books or not. And maybe you're not the right person to ask, any of you at the table. It's more of our question to ask ourselves if we're going to stay on that commitment that's put into law, or do we simply repeal it? And I guess that's a policy question that we should sometimes ask. Because we keep escalating salaries, we keep escalating budgets, but that little commitment way back kind of has been left out of our formula. So just a historical note, Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Limmer, I think it is true that state budgets have shifted financial burdens to the local units of government rather than maintain our state levels of commitment for a variety of reasons, an unwillingness to cut certain amounts out of state budgets and an unwillingness to raise revenues for the state budgets to make the funds available.
Mr. Chair, sometimes they're discretionary and other times they're actually written into law. And so our budget process is sometimes flexible, and other times it's black and white.
Senator Limmer, I think the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system that for decades were not funded in accordance with the aspirational goals in statute of the state paying two-thirds of their costs of providing the education and keep up with enrollment increases as well by statute, they would sympathize with the local counties here because they had to find their revenues somewhere else in order to do that, and the state just ignored the statute that said they were supposed to do, pay at those levels. I will note that we have not been able to get a hold of anyone from the Board of Public Defense, so we will pass along the inquiry and get the information for the committee. Are there any other thoughts or questions about our budget? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember some of these entities were asking for additional support or put additional thoughts out in front of us on possibly a little different than the governor's budget. I don't believe that's reflected in here. Are we going to get a summary on that anywhere, or do we have to go back and look at all my notes from all the different proposals?
Well, the question is one of process, I think, here. And traditionally, the process has been that after we've concluded this portion of the information gathering and analysis, that the chair, in consultation with whomever the chair wants to consult, which will include members of this committee, will make a recommendation. And then the committee will consider the recommendation and the opportunity to change it or adopt it or whatever the committee wants to do. Mr. Turner, was that a fair description of the process? And since I'm the new chair here, I'm figuring this out too.
Mr. Chairman, that was excellent. I will add, though, that if Senator Dietzick wants to talk to me about the three or four, mainly they're court-based, I'd be willing to talk with her about that.
I think that goes for anyone on the committee. If you have a specific question that you want to ask Mr. Turner, feel free to contact him directly. Or our committee administrator, and we can get information from any of the line items in the budget as well directly if we don't already have it. We don't have the February forecast yet, and sometime after that we will get a target for this committee from the Senate leadership, and then we will have to work within that target to allocate our budget. Unlike some committees, we don't have large areas of discretionary spending that we can shift around as easily. Most of our budget areas are less discretionary in that regard. So that will be a challenge for us, and we should all lobby our leadership to get as large a piece of the target pie that we can. Needs in our committee. Any other thoughts or comments or questions for Mr. Turner or any of those in the audience regarding our budget? All right, then I do have a couple of announcements before we adjourn. We are scheduled on Thursday to hear six policy bills, but I'm also informed that, is it on Thursday? There are two bills up on the Senate floor that it's anticipated may take a fair amount of time. That's the disadvantage of being the noon committee. If the session runs over on Thursdays, it cuts into our committee time. It might take up much or all of our committee time on Thursday on the Senate floor. So it is our intent, and I hope everyone can accommodate this, that we will meet next week during our regular committee times, and also Tuesday evening, possibly Thursday evening, and possibly on Friday from noon until 6. The goal is to move forward the policy bills that we have already before us before we get into a crunch with the re-referrals, which is going to be cause some time pressure for us. And we can deal with it, get ahead of the curve a little bit, and have some of these additional meetings now rather than having to run an even more ragged schedule right up against the deadlines. So I'm hopeful that the committee can look at your schedules and do your best to accommodate that. With that, unless there are any other thoughts or comments, so the committee is adjourned. Thank you.